Hello, it's Paul Scott here. Today I'm talking to Rick Traynor, who is Executive Chairman of Begbies Traynor, ticker BEG. Hello, Rick, and thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Paul. It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So the share price at the moment is 46p and the market cap is 51 million. Quick disclaimers, as usual, I'm not giving any financial advice or recommendation. I'm not charging a fee for this interview, and I do currently hold a relatively small long position in this share. Okay, so let's start off, if you wouldn't mind, Rick, just giving us a description of the business for people not familiar.
Yes, of course. The business is fundamentally an insolvency practice, or has been until some recent diversification, and that involves the administering of the affairs of businesses and individuals, but mainly businesses, that have financial problems and ultimately go into some form of insolvency like liquidation or administration, which are obviously terms that your investors will be familiar with. That involves professional people selling their services predominantly on a time basis across a significant number of cases. We are the largest appointment taker of insolvency matters in the UK for corporate businesses and very much in the SME marketplace. So we do more than anybody else does in terms of volume. We also do personal insolvency as well, to a lesser extent, which is obviously individuals who get into financial problems and have to have their affairs administered by somebody else. And a lot of that emphasis on personal insolvency for us is in respect of non-incorporated businesses, which have to be dealt with under personal insolvency laws rather than corporate insolvency laws, rather than volume IVAs, which is something that other businesses tend to specialise in, but we don't. Recently, in addition to our core business of insolvency, we have diversified into professional services giving property advice, with the acquisition of a business called Edison's and then some recent add-ons to that business. And that now represents probably about 25% of what we do. And the reason we've done that is it gives us a larger marketplace to expand into. And also, again, as your investors will know, the insolvency world has been somewhat quiet over recent years. So the growth potential hasn't been there within our core business. So those are the two main areas, insolvency and property services advice.
Okay, so just touching on the property services side of things, as that's a relatively recent addition to the business, what way do you target that sector in terms of making acquisitions?
Well, we started with what was a relatively sizable business, probably number 25 or so in terms of size in the UK. The biggest players in that market, the likes of Savills, etc., of course, have turned over into the hundreds of millions. Whereas Edison's is 12 or 13 million turnover, but still a relatively sizable business given how fragmented that industry is at the lower end. So we bought that as a strong base, a business that we knew, and we knew the management had the potential to run a larger business, and we're identifying opportunities, typically businesses which are turning over 1 to 3 million, at a local level around the country to add to one of the service lines that Edison's have, which the major service lines being valuation, agency, property auctions, property management, and plant and machinery valuation and sale, and some general consultancy advice. So they're the main areas of activities of Edison's, and we're looking at buying businesses that either specifically go into one of those service lines, or it's a general practice business which will do a number of those activities, and we will fold that into our existing management setup.
Okay, so presumably then, since Begbies deals with a lot of disposals of businesses and business assets, presumably that then gives you a channel to push through, Begbies' own disposals.
Yes, that's right. So almost every insolvency, will have hard assets to sell, be it property or plant and machinery. And we will instruct a business like Edison's to sell those on our behalf. Now that Edison's is within the camp, of course, we can use those services and retain that fee income within Begbies Traynor rather than it going to a third-party organisation.
Yeah, and presumably if you own the business, you're as a client, a high priority for them as well, I imagine.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And clearly we have issues we have to deal with and do deal with about being any conflict of interest and ensuring that the fees that Edison's charged to those insolvencies are fair and reasonable. But as you say, at the very least, we'd expect that we're going to get top priority in terms of service level from Edison's, which we do, at a very sensible fee rate.
Yeah, you actually preempted my next question. I was about to ask you about conflict of interest. I mean, how do you actively manage that then to make sure it's sort of whiter than white when you're pushing your own business through the Edison's and so on?
Well, there are specific rules that cover that, and what happens is that our fees as insolvency practitioners are agreed by creditors.
Oh, I see.
And the fees of professionals that we use are agreed not by creditors but by us. Mm-hmm. And the exception is that if we use Edison's, then those fees are agreed by creditors. So they just, in the eyes of creditors, they're exactly the same as our own fees, and they have to have a third-party approval.
I see. Okay, brilliant. Shall we move on to talking about the insolvencies market then? Because it's obviously very cyclical, so you're counter-cyclical, and you depend on recessions really for the big burst of business. But that pattern completely changed in 2008, didn't it?
Well, what happened in 2008, we had a recession, as everybody's aware, and the number of appointments for about 18 months went up, as one would have anticipated. But then rather than continuing to rise, which on the back of the size of the problems and the number of businesses in the economy times the normal rate of insolvency would have meant that numbers would have been even higher in subsequent years. So we'd have expected in 2010 and 2011 the numbers to continue to rise above what was the peak looking back in 2009. But that didn't happen, and principally it didn't happen because of the interest rate policy. Interest rates came down to next to nothing, of course, the base rate. Also, banks were in a position where they were keen not to crystallise losses on existing loans, so were happy to allow borrowers to continue as long as they were covering that relatively small amount of interest, rather than traditionally they probably would have sought to get their capital back by putting a business into some form of administration or receivership and using our services to do that. And obviously there was a degree of government pressure as well not to force insolvencies, and that pressure I think was felt with both by the banks and also by HM Customs and Excise, who are the major instigators of insolvencies for smaller companies in respect of taxes that have not been paid over, usually payroll taxes that should have been paid over and haven't been.
Yeah.
So we didn't see that normal pattern. You're absolutely right. So we've been in an interesting position in recent years where insolvencies have been at the lowest rate for many decades, despite the fact there's still significant underlying problems with lots of businesses in the UK.
Yeah, yeah. It's a remarkable set of circumstances, really, isn't it? I mean,
Do you see?
I mean, I've been saying in my blog that interest rates are going to go up at some point. I've been saying that for 8 years now, and it still hasn't happened. So, I mean, do you think interest rates will ever go up, and what sort of effect will that have, do you think?
Well, I suspect one day they will. Whether I'll see it in my career or not is a different matter. As you say, every time you think there's a likelihood of it starting to happen in the current financial year, some additional problem arises, and it's put back for a year or two. So I suspect with all the issues we've got or are going to face with Brexit, etc., we're going to see interest rates remain low for at least the next few years.
Yeah, interesting. okay, sorry, I lost my place on my list here. Where was I? Yeah, so the attitude of the banks then. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds like the attitude of the banks is likely to remain very accommodative then. For the time being,
I think that it is, and I think a lot of those problems which never resulted in a formal insolvency, either exceptionally the business has turned itself around, or it has just petered out. It has just gradually run out of assets, run out of business, and effectively liquidated without a formal procedure.
Yes, Yes, I mean, I know several small businesses that where I know the owners who are, you know, still in a complete financial mess and have been for years, but they just seem to somehow tread water, beg, borrow, and steal to cover the payroll each month. And I mean, I was told by a small firm of accountants a couple of weeks ago that apparently HMRC will more or less accept any reasonable proposal that's put to them for deferred payment. I mean, is that ringing true to you, do you think?
Well, the number of formal deferred payment deals that the revenue have been getting into recently has fallen, is our understanding.
Okay.
But the number of informal deals, as you say, seems to be rising.
Mm.
I think the pragmatic view of, well, if we force this business into insolvency, we're not going to get those arrears anyway.
Yes.
So we're better off just letting it plod forward, keep employing the employees that it's got rather than them being claimants on the state.
Yes.
And, you know, just it may be that eventually it turns itself around and we don't have a problem. Maybe we even get some of our arrears back.
Mm, yeah, so the net impact
on... understand.
Yes. I mean, the net impact on the government, as you say, is probably positive, isn't it? From allowing businesses to just struggle on and at least pay some payroll taxes rather than those people claiming benefits.
Yeah.
Okay, should we look at pre-packs as well? This has been a controversial area for a number of years, pre-pack administrations, where the business has sort of flipped almost instantly to a pre-arranged buyer. I mean, there's been quite a bit of press lately about this being, you know, other creditors, in particular unsecured creditors, being disadvantaged by this. I mean, what's your view on pre-packs?
Well, my view is that it's a very important tool for insolvency practitioners to use to try and salvage something from an insolvent situation. And while it's understandable that creditors can look at it and think that somehow they've been cut out of the process and a cosy deal has been done with directors to sell businesses back to them, which often it is back to directors, not always, that is far from the case. In the vast, vast majority of situations, there wouldn't have been another deal to be done. And doing a pre-pack minimises the negative impact on the ongoing business. So customers, for example, who, if it went into a formal insolvency, would immediately, understandably, look for another source of supply for their goods, are being able to assure straight away that, in fact, that business is continuing to move forward and that supply of goods is secure moving forward, so there's no need to look elsewhere. So it's more likely to retain some business within the business that's gone through a pre-pack. It's more likely to retain the employment within that business, and it's more likely to maximise the value of the assets, which eventually will be returned to some of the creditors, although in many instances, of course, the unsecured creditors, like most insolvencies, don't get a return. The return goes to secured creditors and the preferential creditors.
Yeah. So really speed is of the essence then in terms of safeguarding the ongoing business, I guess.
Yes, that's absolutely right, yes, because to try and run it in insolvency, that trading within insolvency while you look for another buyer also requires funding. Someone's going to have to pay for those continuing trading losses, and by and large, there isn't the funds within those businesses to do that.
Yeah, it's funny because I started my career with Price Waterhouse, and it was in 1990 to 93 I was with them, and of course the insolvencies then went off the scale. The banks were being so brutal and interest rates were so high. And I ended up running a Rolls-Royce garage in Bournemouth, almost fresh out of university. There I was, sort of left in charge on site. You know, it was absolutely bizarre.
That's one of the best things about insolvency as an insolvency practitioner, is that sort of situation.
Yeah.
Is that you never know quite what business you'll be running next week.
Yes. I mean, I found I learned far more actually on the insolvency jobs than I did on, you know, about real nitty-gritty of running a business than I did from the audit work.
It was exactly the same for me. And most people who are insolvency practitioners have got into it by mistake.
Yes.
they've been auditors in a large firm, as it sounds like you were and I was, and suddenly all hands to the pump because an insolvency comes in, and you get involved and you realise, actually, this is real life, real time stuff, and a lot more exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, do you find, the flip side of that, obviously, it can be quite depressing at times, can't it, dealing with failed businesses and the interpersonal issues. I mean, I remember having one employee burst into my office and start screaming and shouting at me, and luckily I managed to pacify him, but it was close to physical violence. You know, I mean, do you find that the job can grind people down? Is it depressing? Or, I mean, how do you cope on a sort of personal level with those type of pressures?
Well, I think it can be depressing, but I think probably more often than not, it isn't, because you're actually going in and leaving the problems. So you're going and taking on your shoulders the problems that others have struggled with for months or even years, and there's a visible feeling of relief that now it's somebody else's responsibility to try and sort this out.
Good point.
Yeah, but invariably within an insolvency, somebody's losing money. You know, there is somebody who is disadvantaged by it, and sometimes, understandably, they're very emotional about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, bedside manner is important.
Yes, and often, as you say, I mean, these situations are never a surprise, are they? Everybody's known for a substantial length of time that the writing's been on the wall. So, yeah, it can be cathartic, I guess. Okay, let's talk about the future then. I see you had one of your quarterly red flag reports out this morning, which are issued on the RNS, which I think are always a very interesting read to give, investors background over a wide base of companies that you cover. I mean, it was surprisingly upbeat this morning. You said financial distress
absolutely.
Has fallen 6%, which I'm surprised at.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, most of that information that goes into there is looking backwards. I mean, a lot of it very recent looking backwards, like county court judgments, etc., which are relatively real time, as opposed to information which also is included in there, which is published accounts and the movement on the profit and loss account and net assets, etc., all goes into those figures. Whereas the litigation is much more real time, but it is looking backwards. So it'll be interesting as we move forward over the course of the next 6 to 12 months to see what sort of impact there will be, if there is any, in terms of the uncertainty that's now been thrown up by what's going to happen with the European Union.
Yeah, I mean, those really Brexit and the devaluation of sterling were the two main themes I was interested in hearing your views on. I mean, sterling, I looked at the stats this morning. I mean, it's dropped 25% against the dollar in the last year, which is a gigantic move. And
absolutely.
I mean, that's bound to, it's going to feed through to much higher prices in the shops, I think, and higher raw materials prices. So, I mean, should we be wary of particular sectors, like, for example, smaller retailers or any other sectors?
Yes, I think that there's some obvious ones where they're going to feel that pressure, and retail is the obvious one, isn't it? You're going to see pressures on prices in shops and margins being squeezed for those retailers.
Obviously,
you're going to see it coming through in at the pump as well, and energy prices are going to be impacted by it.
But it should help exporters and cause some
substitution
as well, shouldn't it?
Absolutely, there are swings and roundabouts there, and it'll be interesting to see how that feeds through. But undoubtedly, from the economy point of view, it'll be interesting to see how it feeds through. But from an individual business point of view, there definitely will be winners and there will be losers.
Yeah. And on Brexit, I mean, nothing's actually changed as yet, is it? So it's only really sentiment that's been impacted so far. I mean, have you got a sort of a view on the most likely what will actually happen in terms of trade deals and so on?
I've no more idea than anybody else at the moment, and it seems to be the same speculation just washing round in circles, isn't it, at the moment, what the outcome is going to be. It just seems that it's going to be very difficult to negotiate exactly what we'd like, given the structure of who we're negotiating with. It's not a one-on-one at all. It's a huge committee that has to agree to whatever the final outcome is going to be. And that pushes you more towards thinking it's going to be a bit of a tougher exit and a bit more a matter of starting from scratch rather than just taking the good bits that we'd like and leaving the bits that we don't like or some of us don't like.
We've had three questions from my blog readers as well, which are quite interesting questions, so maybe if we go on to those next.
Sure.
We've got somebody who's just given their name as the letter S, so they want some anonymity. They've asked, what effect would a 1% rise in interest rates have on your revenue and profit?
The answer to that is I just don't know. At the margin, it's likely to generate more business, and if we generate more business, we're likely to increase profits because we have capacity within our team, although our team has reduced substantially in number over the last few years to tailor it towards the market that we currently have rather than the one that we hoped we were going to have. We still have some capacity in there, so we could deal with that marginal work relatively cheaply because we have the staff already. But exactly how it would impact us, I don't know the answer to that. I wish I did. I wish there was a formula in place that we could directly link any increase in interest rates to the amount of additional business we're likely to get. But I think it's more likely to have an impact on consumer spending and directing affecting businesses from that direction rather than it is from the cost of borrowing for a business. I think that, you know, really at the margin, of course, 1% to some businesses would make all the difference, but to most of them, it wouldn't make that much of a difference to whether they stay in business or not. But on the other side of things, if consumer demand is impacted materially by a 1% increase in interest rates, then it would have an impact.
Okay. And also, I suppose, there'd be an effect on your own borrowings because you've got quite an unusual balance sheet, which seems to be a sort of a feature of the sector generally, in that you have this very large debtor book of sort of accumulated billings, which are, I guess, are invoiced at the end of each job, and then quite a hefty amount of bank debt supporting that. Presumably your borrowings are on a floating rate interest, are they?
Yes, that's right, yes, yeah. So you're right.
There'll be a bit of impact there, I guess,
as well. There'll be a bit of impact there. We fund the work that we've done and haven't yet been paid for by that bank debt. So, so there is a relationship there. And if we got busier, one would anticipate that that amount of funding would increase.
So your business is cash flow hungry when you expand, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. I mean, is there anything you can do to change the structure of the balance sheet? Could you somehow alter the way jobs are done with sort of interim billings to reduce that debtor figure going forwards?
Not really, no. I mean, we do interim billings. Billings are related to a very large extent to realisations on cases because, of course, creditors want paying on an ongoing basis as well. So if we're in a position to pay something to creditors because we've sold some assets, then at that point in time, we'd ask to take some fee on account. So that already does happen. You're right, with some cases, the realisation's right at the end, in which case you get all your fee at the end. But on a lot of cases, and particularly the larger ones, it is on an ongoing basis. Typically, on average, across the whole of our caseload, the time it takes to get paid for doing an hour's worth of work today, we'd expect to get paid about 7 or 8 months down the track for it. That's across the whole portfolio of jobs. So the only way it could change was if there'd be a change within our industry, and, for example, with the banks, where they actually paid us ahead of them getting any realisations from cases. And frankly, I can't see that happening, I'm afraid.
No, good point, good point. I mean, normally I wouldn't invest in any company with a really stretched debtor book, but because I've worked in the sector myself, I know how it works, and it's not actually a problem necessarily. But, I mean, do you end up with any amounts in the receivables book that you have to write off?
Oh, yes, we do, yes, because on some cases the asset realisations aren't sufficient for us to be paid in full.
Right.
So that does happen, and part of the skill of an insolvency practitioner is taking on a job at the outset that you think you can get paid on because there's no absolute certainty. But overall, the number of cases where we don't get paid is pretty low, and there are some cases that work out very well, which compensate for them. But as you say, you understand the way that our industry works, and you can see it's not a problem. Unfortunately, it's exactly the same for the banks, of course, who really understand our industry because we're working for them most of the time. So there's never a problem with the banks seeing where the value is in that book and being prepared to fund it.
Yeah, and I mean, last time I looked, your overdraft was unsecured.
Yes, that's right.
Which is a sign of, you know, immense confidence by the banks, isn't it? basically.
Yes, it is, yes. Yeah, we're very pleased with that, and we don't anticipate that's likely to change in the near future.
Yeah.
As I say, the banks understand what we do, and they know that that value is there in those cases. It just takes some time for it to unwind.
So if necessary, I'm imagining it would be fairly straightforward to increase the overdraft if business picked up heavily. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's our view. And indeed, if you look in the past, you know, we've had much more significant borrowings funding a much larger debtor book. And that's come down, as you'd anticipate, it's come down as the market has shrunk, and you'd anticipate that that would go in the other direction if we got busier.
Yeah, okay. Just going back to the reader questions then, we've got two questions from Christopher, who's an existing shareholder. He says, with reduced staff numbers, how will you cope with a sudden increase in insolvencies?
Well, the answer to that is that we have capacity within our existing staff to cope with more work. And we would anticipate we could do another 10% on top of what we're doing at the moment without materially changing the size and cost of the cost base.
Okay.
And for a short period of time, we could probably do 20% by people working longer hours. Again, as you know, as you've worked in insolvency, if the work's there, you do it. And if that means it's 7 days a week and it's long hours, then that's what you do. Of course, you can't do that forever, and there would come a point if that activity increase was more than a blip and was sustained for a period, that eventually we'd have to recruit more people. We wouldn't see that as being a significant problem because, first of all, there are lots of people who have worked in the industry and aren't currently working in it because the industry has shrunk. Everybody's done exactly the same as us. And secondly, there is that ability to bring in people who are financially literate, but without insolvency experience, again, going back to your experience and mine when I first moved over to insolvency, you go in as part of the team directed by the insolvency practitioner, and there's a lot of work you can do because you understand company accounts and the financial side of things. So long as you're properly supervised, then you can add value to the process. So we can add to the team.
That's very much my recollection, although I'm a bit rusty now going back 25 odd years, but I do recall that really, I mean, there's only one qualified person covering numerous jobs with a huge team of people below them, a lot of whom were very junior.
Yeah.
And I mean, the qualification itself is extraordinarily difficult, isn't it? I mean, I remember some really high up people within PW insolvency who still couldn't pass exams because they're so tough. How many jobs and how many staff below them can each qualified person handle, would you say?
Well, I mean, it does depend on the size of those jobs, of course, because some are substantial trading administrations which require a team out in the field to deal with them. Some are effectively desktop exercises where a business has ceased to trade. It's a very small liquidation or bankruptcy. And those are different teams that make up those two different types of activities. And the number of cases they would deal with would vary as well. But it's likely that somebody who was dealing with an average size of case across the board in our particular marketplace with a team of people would probably be dealing with more than 100 cases at any given point in time. A lot of those are non-current, of course. So you're not rushing around dealing with 100 ongoing trading businesses. A lot of those businesses have got past that stage, and they're down to the stage where it is a desktop exercise to sort out exactly who the creditors are, to realise the rest of the assets which might be chasing debts or litigation or something along those lines, or waiting for a property to sell, and then eventually there's a dividend paid out from it.
Okay. Actually, that brings us on neatly to the next question, which was about your dividends. Christopher has said the dividend, I think it's 2.2 pence a year, has not been changed for a few years. Is it still sustainable going forwards at that level?
Well, our view at the moment is that it is, subject to the world not changing for the worse. And by mm-hmm. that, I mean our world not changing for the worse. Of course, if the rest of the world changes for the worse, then we'd hope there'd be a dividend increase in due course. But But at the moment, assuming that insolvency is relatively stable at the level it's at, and our property services business is doing well and we anticipate will expand over the next few years, then we think that it's sensible to look at the dividend at least staying where it is. And obviously, in the fullness of time, we hope to be able to start pushing that dividend up again.
Mm. Well, that's reassuring. Because, I mean, one of the reasons I bought back into your share, I mean, I've dipped in and out of your share a number of times over the years, sort of waiting for business to pick up, and then it didn't happen, so I moved on, you know.
But
I thought the reason I bought back in more recently is I thought it's actually quite a nice hedge against my portfolio of long positions in other companies. You know, if the economy does go into recession, then you're counter-cyclical, so you'll benefit. And in the meantime, I get a nearly 5% dividend yield while I wait, which you know, isn't bad, really, I think, overall. That's concluded all of my questions. So thank you very much indeed for that. I mean, are there any points you want to cover that we haven't mentioned already?
I think that we've covered all the major ones, which is the state of the market, the impact of that on our core business, which is very boring, steady as it goes. The opportunity for expansion for us over the next few years, we think, is the property side of things. But who knows what is going to happen with our relationship with Europe and the next 12 or 18 months. And we retain a very good position within our core business to take advantage of that. And also the other nice thing is that Edison's, which is the property side of the business, also has a lot of expertise in that distressed marketplace. So it isn't a matter of insolvency does well and their business falls off a cliff. Insolvency does well and a significant part of their business will actually be doing well at the same time.
Yeah. And, I mean, also, just as a remark, really, it's reassuring to see that a firm of accountants can actually survive on the stock market without itself going bust, because I think everyone else who's tried it...
Yes, absolutely. Well, Touchwood, we don't go the same way, but...
well, it's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, I can't remember the names of them off the top of my head, but there were at least two.
Well, Tenon was the sort of the bigger one, wasn't it? Tenon and Vantis and Numis and... You know, there was a spate where there's at least half a dozen of them which were all trying
crazy,
to do it, but didn't.
I mean, they all seemed to take on too much debt and expand too fast, didn't they? I think that was what they got wrong, which, again, for firms of accountants is a schoolboy error, isn't it?
It is, absolutely, yes.
It's crazy. Yeah. So, I mean, congratulations on being, the shiny example of a firm that's avoided those pitfalls. So.
The last one standing. Thank you, Paul.
Yes. Brilliant. Well, thanks for your time, Rick. I've really enjoyed chatting to you, and maybe we can catch up in 12 months' time or something and see how the world's changed.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to do that, and thanks again for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rick. Cheerio, then.
Cheers. Bye now.